goodness. Hey everybody, my name's Randy Oswalt, and I'm an alcoholic. Gosh, it's great to be with y'all this weekend. I was trying to, I got a head cold. I'm trying to get through, so y'all bear with me each night before I'm not hearing voices anymore in my head. But each night before I go to bed, it's kind of sound like a pack of howling coyotes. Trying to get through that. This has just been the most awesome thing. It is absolutely, I've learned from coming into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, this is a privilege to get to be invited to participate with you people. I learned that from y'all, and I hope I always remember that. Compared to where I came from, stuff like this just doesn't happen except by the grace of a loving God and a program of recovery and the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm so thankful for that. You people, what's been so special is I have felt the presence of God this weekend. I feel that through you people, through the people in my home group. I feel God. I hear God through you people. And the term that Bill uses in our big book is altruistic. And I know I'm in with a group of altruistic people, people who have selfless concern for others. I didn't know anything about giving when I got here. And it's been a big job trying to go from a taker to trying to give. And through y'all's examples and your faces and your spirit, it encourages me and it shows me this thing works. And there's a lot of good giving people out there. And it's just been a blessing to be here with y'all. There's three very important things in my sobriety. One, I do have a sobriety date, June the 27th, 1994. Tough time back then. Another very important part of my sobriety is I do have a sponsor, David I. of Columbus, Mississippi. I wouldn't be here today if it wasn't for David and people like Charles and Suzanne. And the third extremely important part of my sobriety is I do have a home group. It's a happy hour group of Alcoholics Anonymous. We meet 6 days a week, every day but Saturday, in Columbus, Mississippi. AA-Mississippi.org, and look for Columbus. I would love to have y'all if you're ever through Columbus. I'll try to share in a general way a little bit about what it was like for me and what happened and what it's like today. I'll give you a little bit of my background. I came from just as normal a blue-collar family as you could want to see. Like has been said already this weekend, the fact that I turned out like a turd is no reflection at all of my mom and daddy. I'll guarantee you that. They were as good a quality of just loving parents that would absolutely were givers. They were all about giving, and I was all about taking. They provided well for us. I'm the youngest of three boys. They've got a reason to be a little neurotic. Between the three of us, they've been through 6 marriages, 5 divorces, a tour of Vietnam, a real hippie, and a real alcoholic. they're awesome people. They're in their mid-80s now, and they love what Alcoholics Anonymous has done for their baby. Coming up early on, I was a whoopsie. My brother was going off. My oldest brother was going off to Vietnam when I was 5 years old. they provided for us. My daddy was a hard worker. He drove a truck, long haul truck for 43 years. Mama took the responsibility, and after she had finished her career with the telephone company, she was a stay at home mom with me. And they provided well for us. They did everything they could to make sure that we were happy and fed and had clothes on our back. They went with us to church and taught us morals and responsibilities and taught us right from wrong. And I'm so grateful for that. From Columbus and relocated through my dad's job into Petersburg, Virginia for several years, and then Charlotte, North Carolina. Which is where I did the biggest part of my growing up. It's where my drinking career really took off. You know, I remember a couple of things. 10 or 11 years old, with the guys and this thing about alcohol, there was a near beer out called Chelsea. And somehow we got a bag full of this stuff and we went back to the fort. And nobody was really drunk, but we were all acting drunk. And it was just that lure of have seen this on TV, and it's like, it was just this, you know, that was just kind of like the scene. That was cool. And I remember thinking about that, and several years later, going through high school, I had these, just trying to grow up, and I wish I needed the book back then, I needed the program back then. I would have these emotions, and we talk about it a lot, and you hear about it from the podium a lot. You know, just didn't feel like I fit in. There was nothing on the outside that made me that should have made me think that. Nobody said, "Randy, you know, your mama dresses you funny. You know, you're just weird." Nobody ever told me that. I just felt it. Nobody said, "You know, your car's not as cool as Chuck's," right? But I would think it. You know, I just don't have the coolest car, and just don't have the coolest clothes. Never said, you're a bad athlete. No, they did tell me that. I was third string football. When I got to you people, I was first string all North Carolina State from 1981. But that's another story. You know, but I was doing the best I could. I was trying to wrest satisfaction and happiness out of this life, managing well. And that's just the way it went. I was involved in a great church there in North Carolina and got involved in the youth program and started taking part and having a good time and had some genuine beliefs about the church and about God and about a spiritual way of life and I began at an early age to have a honest desire to know and do God's will for my life. And had made a commitment and made a decision to pursue that through school and higher education to try to do church work and carry that message that had been given to me in the church. I graduated and went on to a little small Baptist school there in North Carolina, Gardner Webb College, and with full intentions, just gung-ho about this desire to know and do God's will and try to carry that message. And still having these internal, we call them defects of character, pride, ego, and all those things that were playing a part. I would see things going on at the campus that, you know, I would know that, you know, that's probably not the right way to be living your life. And there was always a power play there, and I would see folks that seemed like they were just, you know, the A team. I was living in the athletic dorm and see the guys and how they carried themselves, and I would think, man, that is just, they're just, this is the coolest folks. But you know, I'm here for a reason. And I went through that for about the first semester, and made pretty good grades, and things went well. The second semester, Bill talks about worldly clamors, mostly within myself. I felt the nearness of God and longed for that. But those worldly clamors, mostly within myself, there was a, for some reason I had wandered into a party and there was just a gathering of guys up there, and they were passing around Jack Daniel's whiskey and Coke, and he said, you know, it'll be okay, just, you know, have you a drink. And I was thinking, worldly, that's if you notice, that's where I stumbled there. I started thinking, God did turn water into wine, and I'm sure that God wouldn't mind if I had a drink. It's just a drink, and you know, I won't indulge. I'd heard that word, and I don't know. I did, and something happened in my life and in my body. It burnt going down, and it felt like a cherry bomb going off in my belly. For an alcoholic of my type, it turned into the magical elixir of life. And I didn't understand what was going on. All these inadequacies, feelings of less than that I was feeling at a young age seemed to go away. And they told me I had a great time that night. and that pretty much is the tone of my drinking career. I was a blackout drinker. When I started, I didn't fool around with it. I started drinking large quantities from the jump, chasing that feeling. I remember the horrible hangovers the next morning. I remember how I felt. I remember the struggle between what's right and what's wrong. This is not right. But man, I had found something that changed me in such a way that, that I was not going to be without. It did something for me that I had been looking for my whole life. I felt like I was just as good an athlete as the guys in the dorm I was living in. I felt like I was better most of the time. and if they knew what they had, they would have redshirted me in. I had just as nice a vehicle, and for some reason, every cute girl on campus was talking about me, and it was just magical. And I started not being able to differentiate the truth from the false at an early age. Lived in a fantasy. We talk about a fantasy we live in, but I don't know. It was electrifying. Things started out real good there, but by four semesters and wasted a lot of my mom and daddy's money, I was on academic expulsion and disciplinary. Couldn't go back because of my grades and my conduct, and for a long time. When I started drinking, I started damaging property. And that was pretty much of a tone of my drinking, too. I damaged a lot of property. But that was okay because I didn't need that anymore. I had found the good life. And things were just absolutely, in my mind, going great. I had found something that made me feel like I was alive and I was a part of. Now, I knew right and I did wrong, and there's a price to pay for that. And it was a tough one on me. But those worldly clamors, mostly within myself, blotted those feelings of that honest desire to know and do God's will out. Got back to Charlotte, and you know how we are. I found a group that run just like I did, and that's what we did is we ran. We lied just alike. There's another thing, when I drink, I lie. Anything to say or do to make you think that I'm okay. Because I knew what was going on. Book talks about, that I always wanted to enjoy a certain reputation, but I knew deep inside my heart I didn't deserve it. That was me. I wanted to be that A-team. I wanted to wear the letter from the football, but, I knew I didn't deserve it. But I would make you think I did. And would wear those masks and be able to try to fit in wherever I could. I started seeking out folks that a fellowship of men and women that drank just like I did. I was a beer joint drinker. The crummier, the redneckier, the countryer, the dirt floorish brick wall. I love the neon lights. I love the smell. And y'all know what I'm talking about of a redneck beer joint. Just awful. But I thought it was electrifying. Man, when I get in there and get on that bar stool, I felt like I was right at home. And as the night would progress, I didn't start getting DUIs right off the bat. I was having a good time drinking. And I know I was a real alcoholic right then, but I was managing fairly well. I've always been real good at getting a job. Keeping a job has always been my problem. I don't know if any of y'all have ever heard it, and this used to drive me crazy. You know, you got a lot of potential, and that would be preceded with, but we got to let you go. Underachiever, anyway, I didn't realize it. Looking back, everything I've learned about my life has been a result of coming into AA and seeing what was happening back there. But my life started making a pretty gradual, pretty hard descent downward when I started drinking. I did the deal for a lot of years, you know, in charge of my own destiny, trying to make a living, make a career, make a future, trying to figure out which direction I was supposed to go in life, and just drinking the whole time, passing out. I used to pass out early on. For some reason, I quit passing out. Probably would have saved a lot of scrapes and a lot of DUIs. I don't know, between the blackouts, the body and this mouth would just keep right on going. There's a lot of times I wish I'd have just passed out somewhere, but and got the bruises and picking. I'm still picking glass out of the back of my head from beer bottles. There's a lot of times I should have shut up instead of stand up. I wasn't a good fighter like Charles. I would think I would. And you drink enough Jack Daniels, and I felt bulletproof, but the next morning I realized I wasn't. That's the insanity of continuing to stand up when you're not supposed to. I just couldn't do it. I wasn't tough. But, man, I could drink. We carried on and ran a lot of years and had a lot of big plans, a lot of big designs. The group I was running with, we would, like I said, we lied together. We believed the lies we were telling each other, if that's not crazy, about these big restaurants we were going to build, and so we were sitting at the nice restaurants in Charlotte discussing our business plan and drinking the whole time and inviting the waitresses to be a part of this big adventure. And about midnight, they were wondering where we were at because we'd run off on the tab. And we wasn't big enough that we could pay our way. But it was just all a part of that insanity, that trying to feel like I'm somebody. But knowing inside that I didn't deserve that. So things went along a lot of years like that. I started getting DUIs in the 80s. Back then, now I got 12 DUIs, so that tells you right there I wasn't a good drinker and a driver, but now I love drinking and driving. There was nothing I enjoyed better than putting the country music on, getting on the back roads and riding the roads in an old truck. And that worked pretty good most of the time. I had a lot of years drinking, but I didn't get 12 convictions. I wish I had the money back I've given lawyers. Mothers Against Drunk Drivers put a hurting on me. When they came online and ramped up their program, it put a hurting on me. Before then, you could always pay it out or buy it out. I've had driver's license from Mississippi, Alabama, Georgia, South Carolina, North Carolina. The NCIC deal hadn't got online yet, and you could run. Nowadays, it's tough on a real alcoholic nowadays trying that. They'll catch you. I crashed a lot of cars and did a lot of damage. I started to, at about the age 25, 26, I had really messed things up in North Carolina. My mom and daddy had retired and come back to Mississippi. And I've got a pretty good history of doing what a lot of grown drunks do, is going back to mama's. And when things get bad, I go back to mama's, and they were always, for the most part, would allow me to come back. And so I had really messed up in North Carolina, I realized it was time that I retreat. not retreat, but just move, geographical change. Things wasn't working out good in North Carolina anyway. And so I was done with them, and they were done with me. So I continued this swath of destruction in the state of Mississippi and Alabama. I had managed to get into a fairly decent position. I was going to enter the world of high finance. Now, back when I was at Gardner Webb, I had took like accounting 101 and business 101, and I had convinced myself I was an accountant and believed it. Economics, and you know, I could do some talky talk and throw out some words out there, and I believed it, and I got a job doing this with a large construction company in the accounts payable department. Those folks were real good to me. I've had folks just give me opportunities and believe in me and want the best for me, and I've always managed to throw it in their face. But they let me work on the Weyerhaeuser plant there in Columbus, and gave me an opportunity to move with them to Savannah, Georgia, on another project, major paper mill project. And I stayed there for about 3 months, and they were done. They said, "We've had enough, and you do a great job, but you just don't show up." And I was used to hearing that, and so I come back to Mama's and get back on my feet. That was always the thing with Mama's. Mama has, you just wouldn't understand them folks. they didn't understand, and they gave me a raw deal, and I need a little money, and I'm gonna get back on my feet and get things going again. And that was always my thing, was I just need a little money and to get back on my feet. They were so tired of seeing me get back on my feet. So my next big adventure is the next world of high finance with Heilig Myers Furniture. And in my mind, that's high finance, and I'm in the manager training program, and opportunity to go and move with that company, and I'm thinking, and you know, Range, I'm trying to get my plan back together. If you got to have a plan when you're out there running like I did and drinking like I did, you just always got to have a plan. And this was my new plan. You know, maybe it's time to slow down and drink normal. When I would go to the beer joint, when I would get off at 5, I had full intentions of being home by 10, getting a good night's sleep, and be ready to go into that credit office the next morning and do a good job. I don't know, at 2 o'clock in the morning, it was like my butt was glued to that bar stool. You know, it was, from my own experience, I understand the obsession to swallow alcohol, and I understand from my own experience today that I have an allergic reaction to alcohol. When I start drinking, I can't stop. I'm beyond human aid, and I never understood that. I was never able to accept that, some chunks of truth about myself till I got to you people. But so we did that, and so my next plan was, you know, I'm 27 years old. I need to get married. And so the prettiest girl at the beer joint said yes. And my mom and daddy was not happy. But bless her heart, she got took hostage. So we made plans, and it was going to be wonderful. I was going to slow down, and we were going to have a family together, and we were going to do Heilig Myers, and she was going to keep her job waiting tables, and it was just going to work out. And had full intentions of being a good husband and on my terms. And making this thing work. And I don't know, and we did. We got married, and Heilig Myers Furniture moved me to Hattiesburg, Mississippi, and she came along, and I don't know, bless her heart, I thought that that meant that I could still go to the beer joints every night and do my deal. But she had other plans, and she wasn't drinking, and she thought that we ought to be together every night. And I don't know, I had different ideas. There's another big thing of this that you need to know about me is I'm selfish and self-centered to the extreme. The only thing that really mattered to me was what I wanted to do. And what I wanted to do was, you know, it was kind of like a token. I had the job, I had the marriage, I had the apartment, and I was paying the bills, so by God, I could go out. And, you know, just absolutely no respect, no desire to try to be what I was supposed to be. Didn't know how to be. That's another thing. I didn't know how to be what I was supposed to be. I didn't know that until I got to you people. Only thing I knew was how to live like a crazy fool and run on self-will and fear and those things. And anything that got in the way of me and drinking absolutely had to go. She thought that since we were married, she was going to try to control my drinking for me, and that just didn't work. I would figure out how to just I could push her buttons and make her just mad that she would say, just leave. I'd like, see ya. I wanted to break up on Fridays and get back together on Mondays. It was just, bless her heart, she endured a couple of years of pure D hell. I've always been financially unstable. I've always needed some more money. Never had enough money. Always under finance. Give you an idea of my selfishness. We're about broke. She needs food. So we're at the grocery store, and we're going to the grocery store, and we make our rounds, start at the bread section. She wants good bread. I like the kind with the black stripe on it because it's half price. That makes sense. We're saving money. So we get to the toilet paper. She wants good Charmin. I see some for like 29 cents. That makes sense. We're saving money. Let's get that. She wanted good Oscar Mayer bologna and like King Cotton's 20 cents. Let's get that. Baby, we're saving money. We're strapped. You know, let's buckle down and let's get through this and let's save some money. Inevitably, we make it through the beer section, the last section, and I grab up two cases of Miller Lite. I don't know what happened. I do know what happened. She had had enough, and she embarrassed me. She called me. She called me everything but a child of God in that store, and everybody in that store knew that she had had enough. I'm trying to explain to her, baby, it's on sale. It's a good price. It's by the case. We're saving. And that made sense to me. I don't know about y'all, but it made sense to me. It was a good deal. But she had enough, and she left, and she went to her mama's. About 3 weeks later, I got that called into the office. Randy, you know, you do a good job, but you're just not showing up. They said, and that's true. They give me time. They give me chances and chances and said, you know, this is where we're going to clean your desk out. And this is where we part company. I had a resentment. They just knew how hard I worked for them. The folks in that credit office just wouldn't get online, wouldn't get on board and work right. And I had all these resentments. But I said, I'll show them, you know, that fierce determination to come back. I'll show them, you know, I'll handle it. I loaded up what was left, and I went to her mom's. South Carolina, and had a pretty good little deal there. Her mom and stepdad were in construction, project managers for a construction company, and So we were going to stay there and babysit the younger sister, and that just turned into a nightmare. You know, we were broke, and I actually tried to slow down a little bit, and that was horrible. I never tried to stop drinking. It never crossed my mind to stop. I did try to slow down once, and it absolutely was too painful. I would steal their change out of her mama's and daddy's, her mom and stepdaddy's room, and to go buy whiskey. And they had enough, and so there was another big fight, and I went back to Alabama to my mama's. And a month later, here she comes to my mama's, and that didn't work out at all. So we got us another little place, and I'm not working. I don't know why she kept following me back. We got a little place out by the back gate of the Air Force Base in Columbus, and her mama shows up one Thursday night, and I was pretty ugly in my cups, and had been a pretty ugly scene, and you know that woman, and you got to imagine this, the back gate of an Air Force Base in a crummy little trailer park, and you know that woman had the nerve to whoop me with a bat. I was defenseless. I was so drunk I couldn't stand up. She had had enough. I was so mad. I was livid. And so for the third time that week, the Lowndes County Sheriff's Department showing up, and they're done. That Lowndes County is not a real big county, but they know the drunks, and I had been identified. I had a resentment with that woman for a long time, but we've got a step called the fifth step, and I told my sponsor, he said, you know, how much I hated that woman. He said, he got around to telling me, and this is the beauty of this program. He said, you know, what had you done? I was like, well, Dave, I had tried to be a good husband. And had been up there and took care of them and took care of her sister. And he reminded me that, you know, some abuse that had went on and some real bad things that I had done. And the beauty of this thing is the first time in my life I saw my part, that she had acted and reacted because of what I had been doing. And that was just awesome. It was almost overwhelming at the time, but I saw for the first time that nice lady took it out on me because of the way I was acting, and that was amazing. But so that deal was over. I got my divorce papers and signed them, and that was it. And she was gone. And so the last year of my drinking career, I didn't work. I just didn't even try anymore. I had unemployment checks coming in from three different states. I was delivering steaks at night for a little steak delivery restaurant, and I had this overwhelming desire to get back in the saddle and this delusion that I was going to figure out something. I was going to get my life together. I had learned, this is kind of scary, I had learned to fly a plane back in my 20s. And sometimes I would start at a nice place like one of the hotel beer joints and had an Army-Navy store. And I found a flight jacket. And Air Force was real big in Columbus, and I thought they were the coolest. I love flying. I still get to fly today. I love fighter jets, and man, I would have wanted to be one of them so bad. But you got to go. You got to finish school. You got to go through. You got to take the steps to be a pilot. And that was I couldn't do that. But what I did find is you could buy a jacket and put wings on it. And I was a pilot. And it goes back to that thing, what was going on the inside was just horrible, just sickening. And but if you thought that, hey, man, this guy is cool. Isn't this guy great? And he's a pilot. Well, and you get a couple drinks out of it. It's lively conversation for a couple hours. And then it's, you know, got to get back to the base. And that comes off because when you get to the Purple Chicken, they know you're not a pilot. they know exactly what you are. And kind of like the Southern air. It's kind of funny because the next night, I'm delivering my steaks in my 1981 Pontiac Phoenix. Ugliest car has ever been built. I had sold a really nice Honda and I had the title to it because I needed some cash. So I sold that and got the money and bought this $300 car. Put a fresh three cans of Walmart spray paint job on it, and I was set. And I'm delivering steaks. And I would usually come to about 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And we'd get to the steak place, and so we're delivering steaks, and I walk up to this really nice place and knock on the door, and the man opens the door and says, "Honey, the pilot's here with our steaks." Talk about ego deflation. Oh, that hurt. I mean, he nailed me. He knew exactly, and he knew, and I knew, and he knew that I knew, and I knew that he knew exactly what was going on. Oh, it just killed me. It killed my pride. It was like, hey, I don't know what you're talking about. It's not me. He knew, and I knew, and that hurt. I don't know. I had gotten my fourth. Mississippi had. This one weekend, I got my fourth DUI that Mississippi was charging me with. I was in a lot of trouble. For the first time, I couldn't get bailed out, and I had to call my mom and daddy. I'm so full of pride and ego through the past that I financed my own lawyers. I financed my own bail bondsman because I could do that. You know, that's all about me managing and taking care of myself. I can do it, and I couldn't do it. And they had to come get me out, and we went and talked to a lawyer. And it was going to cost a lot of money for me not to go to prison. And the last thing that Moses Lee said was, "Do not drive." I'm not. And I'm evicted out of this little small apartment that I've been staying in, and things are getting bad, and I don't know it. And sure enough, that Thursday night, I get my fifth. And I called my daddy. I said, "Daddy, you're not going to believe this, but I'm in jail, and can you come get me out?" And he said, "I don't think so." And they were hurt. And they let me stay in there about 3 days, and finally come got me out, and we went to see Moses Lee again, and he knew what he was dealing with, and he knew some things that I didn't know. God was doing for me what I couldn't do for myself. I sat in that little one-room apartment for the last 3 days prior to June 27, 1994, curled up in a fetal position. Absolutely wanting to die. I had not turned out the way I thought I was supposed to. I realized that I had tried as hard as I could to get through this thing and do this deal, and I realized I had failed absolutely miserably. The book talks about that seemingly hopeless state of the mind and body, and that's exactly what I experienced. I experienced fear, terror, bewilderment. That's just hopeless. Life is never going to be okay. It's not going to work out. I'm scared to death. I'm going to prison. I'm not tough enough to make it in prison. I'm going, and I can't tell you the pain that I felt. But y'all know what I'm talking about. alcohol had beat my brains in, and that's what I needed. My daddy had always said, "Boy, you're the hard-headedest thing I've ever seen in my life," and he was true. Alcohol beat me down to a point that to a pain that I don't ever want to go back to. The emotional, the book talks about that intense physical and emotional pain, and I felt it. Life was over as I knew it. And on top of that, I've got to go to drug and alcohol rehab. Thank God, God and my mom and daddy and Moses Lee were doing for me what I was not willing to do for myself. And here I go to the Pines. And I'm like, I'm not an alcoholic. Now, I would give you that I drank pretty hard, and I would admit injurious, but I did not understand anything about alcoholism. The only thing I knew about alcoholism was that Uncle Shorty was an AA member, and he needed to be because he was about 45 when he got here, and he was a bad drunk, and he needed AA. And that was all I knew. My mama had snuck three AA pamphlets in my little apartment one time, and it scared me to death. I just had to cover them up with a newspaper. Never been to an AA meeting. Needed been there a long time. Yeah, I needed this thing for a long time. But I walked into the Pines, and this is a couple of very important things that happened in my life. One, alcohol beat my brains out. Alcohol beat me down so bad that I don't ever want to go back to that pain again. I proved to myself that of myself I am powerless. I have not the ability to manage my life. I cannot manage well. I don't manage well. I cannot drink safely or successfully. I've proven that time and time and time again. From my own experience, I understand the merciless obsession of swallowing alcohol, and I know that once I start drinking, I can't stop because I'm an alcoholic. So I proved that self. I proved that to myself out there. That's my experience. And I got to the Pines, and thank God there were sober members of Alcoholics Anonymous coming into that facility, sharing their experience, strength, and hope. 6 nights a week, we had a speaker meeting on the men's side, and Charles was one of them. People that do what we do, they come up, they've had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps. They share in a general way what their life was like, what happened, what it's like today. And just one of the absolute miracles of this program is I was finally able to identify. I had heard people talking to me about my drinking a long time, and I was just sick of it. I've had the frothy emotional pills. I've had my poor mama, she would be down on her knees, holding my hands, big crocodile tears coming down. "Baby, please stop. You're going to kill yourself. You're going, please, baby, stop." And, "Mama, you don't understand. It's not that bad. It's not like that." They knew exactly what it was like, and I didn't. I love my brother. He tried to help. He would come in, and he would tell me about his post-traumatic stress disorder from Vietnam and try to relate. And I was like, "Jerry, you just, I don't, okay, thanks, man. But please just go." That's as nice as I could be. My middle brother was, that we drank a lot with, was saying, "Man, what's wrong with you? Are you crazy? You're going to drive mom and daddy? Are you trying to drive mom and daddy to the grave?" He said, "Now I'm going to the beer joint, and I want you to think about that." He's a heavy drinker. He's a heavy drinker. My oldest brother's a moderate temperate. My middle brother's a heavy drinker, and I'm the real alcoholic. I was like, "Can you just leave?" Just to say it nicely in here. And I was able to identify from y'all's experience and from you sharing about your alcoholism, I was able to identify, and the recovery started. One alcoholic sharing with another alcoholic. Just like our traditions say, you came and you shared this message to the suffering alcoholic. And that's where it started. I did my first step, my second step, my third step there. A miracle in my life, and I know it's absolutely a miracle, and I love talking about it. 2 weeks into my rehab experience, knowing full well, Moses Lee had explained to me what would happen if I left that facility. And he didn't mince no words about it. 2 weeks into this thing, I was thirstier and I needed a drink worse than I had ever needed a drink before in my life. I knew full well the consequences of going out. A buddy of mine, the night before, went out the window from Belzoni, Mississippi, and I knew right across the catty corner from there, there was a Shell station. I had enough money to get a six-pack, and I needed a drink. You're a real alcoholic. You know what I'm talking about. I needed a drink so bad. It was paramount. It was necessary in my life at that time to drink. I needed a drink. And we had a relief care worker up there named Condor, and he came in, and for the first time I got honest with somebody, and I said, man, I need a drink. And I'm scared. And I don't want to leave. And we went back over the first three steps, and he said, let's do the third step prayer. And I uttered the first sincere prayer that I had uttered in many years. I said, God, please take this obsession away, because I can't do it. I can't do it. And something to that effect. And I think God hears our hearts when we're sincere. And the obsession was removed. And I didn't have to go out that window. And I didn't have to go out and drink. And the consequence, certain consequences that would follow that. I was able to do my fourth step, and I met my sponsor, David. He came in and shared one night, he talked about a little single trailer on a university campus full of bootleg whiskey and weapons, and I identified, and I wanted that. And what he said, his experience, and it sounded pretty good. It sounded a lot better than what I was in. I'd have traded my life with our boxer bulldog at that time. I didn't want what I had. I hurt, and I didn't want to go back to that. There's treatment things you hear about being sick and tired, and you may say, oh, that's treatment stuff. That stuff saved my life. I was sick and tired of being sick and tired. I didn't want what I had. And y'all offered a solution. Man, isn't that awesome? Because of the Program of Alcoholics Anonymous, you showed me a way out and said, this is what we did, and you're free to follow, try whatever you want to try. Do what if you got to do it another way. This is what worked for us, is these 12 steps. And you talk about how good your life was and how well things were going for you and that you wasn't having to drink. And, man, to a newcomer, this is amazing. And I'm like, man, 6 months? You hadn't had a drink in 6 months? And, because newcomers would come with their sponsors and they would get to share. And that made an impact on my life. And somebody with 20 years, like, I can't believe this. But anyway, I got out and I was scared to death. And for the first time in my life, I felt like my life was on the line. When I walked out of the Pines, and I had a home group and a sponsor. And right there is where I met you people in my home group. Y'all shared your message. You shared from your experience based on the book. And Charles and Suzanne were in my home group when I got there. They were there, and I would remember not hearing anything except one little thing that Charles had said. And those were little things that got me through. And he started telling me and showing me that there were certain things that I had to do on a daily basis, prayer and meditation. And Suzanne would talk about 10, 11, and 12 on a daily basis. And I started being able to repeat that. And I wasn't doing it, but it sounded good. And so this went on, and I was dry. And 2 years into this, into sobriety, I hit another bottom. And I was like, and I was hurting inside because I wasn't doing the deal. I said, if it's going to be this bad, if it's going to hurt this bad, I might as well drink. And I picked up my 2-year medallion. And I know Charles said it. I don't know if he said it to me, around me, or if I was just eavesdropping. I heard him say 2 years, and you're either going to grow or you're going to go. And I completely gave myself to this simple program, and my life has got so much better ever since. I hit an emotional bottom. I had hit a physical, mental bottom out there those last 3 days curled up, and I hit another bottom, and I had to learn some things. I had to, I just had to get ready. I had to have my own experience. Folks were telling me the truth, and I just had to do it. Because I had hurt so bad out there, I didn't want to go back. So I completely gave myself to the simple program, and things have been, it's just incredible ever since then. There's been, Bill talks about those trials and low spots ahead. There's been some trials and low spots. I was able to go back to school and finish. You know, during this 2 years, we call it untreated alcoholism in my group. I was dry. I was working for an airline. I was working for Delta Airlines. And these character defects were just, they're ugly. And somebody would make me mad at the ticket counter. And they were going to Orlando, but their bag would go to Bangkok. I'll show them. I promise you, I can tell you what not to do if you're new. Hard-headed. Get honest with your sponsor. Tell them what's going on the inside of you. My solution was to get on my daddy's four-wheeler and go way down in the woods and beat my head against a branch or a pine tree and holler and scream and cry. It was painful growing up. In my group, we talk about growing up in public, and y'all showed me how to grow up. A level of just, Charles used to talk about to be able to act and react in an emotionally mature manner to whatever comes down the pipes. That don't happen. The only thing that's the changes and the way my life is today is a direct result of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I got to a point in sobriety where I submitted myself to this, to our book, to our literature, to my sponsor, to my group, and started trying to adopt their way. And it's worked. The solution is in our book. The solution is in our literature. The solution is in these steps. That's what's given me the best life I've ever known. I got married. I was working, finished school, and I was working in my field, patient care equipment at the hospital, and got married, and a beautiful little baby girl came out of that relationship. She's 7 years old today. Her name's Marley. And 2 years after Marley came along, Abigail Caitlin came along. And I'm 7 years sober, and talking about those trials and low spots, that's why we have to build a firm foundation. And we don't skimp and don't skip steps. And it's absolutely beautiful. One day in my life, I was completely lack of selfishness and self-centeredness. The only thing I was worried about was Andrea and the baby and taking care of them. And this beautiful little baby girl come out, and the doctor is over there, and he waves you over. And Abigail had a little problem. And I had been on my new career. I was not able to make happy hour my home group the way I wanted to, the way I was used to. I had to start trying to make practical application of all these principles in my affairs at work, and I was on the road. I never neglected doing the things I'm supposed to do to stay sober, but I wasn't being able to make my home group like I wanted to. I was on the road, and Abigail had a little problem, and man, the knot that swelled up in my stomach, and I had to go back and tell her mama that everything was fine. Abigail's fingers didn't develop on her left hand, so I had to go. She went to the post op, and had to go tell her mom and daddy, and I finally got by myself, and I it just First thing, I don't do this perfectly. Y'all show me how to live. I still make mistakes, but the first thought was, thanks God. You know, you finally get me back, ain't you? And I was so mad at God. And I was just a pity party, and I was hurt. How could he do this? You finally get me back, ain't you, God? Thanks a lot. And that lasted about 5 minutes. And what came to my mind was, what does the program say? What have they taught you? Why are you being so stupid? And I got down on my knees and I said, God, I will be done. And I was okay. And I did the third step prayer, and I knew it was going to be okay. I knew from my own experience, if I don't get drunk and if I do things I'm supposed to do, it's going to be all right. It's going to be all right. And I had that peace. That only peace within the storm. I always thought you had to have peace outside the storm, and I found it within the storm. And I knew in my heart of hearts, it's going to be all right. Thy will be done. Thy will be done. Thy will be done. Not mine, not mine, not mine, not mine, not mine. And I went back, and I was a daddy again. And I took those 5 minutes and shut myself up and came back as daddy. And we doted over that little thing. She's 5 years old today, and there is nothing slows her down. She can do anything in the world she wants to. She's 5 and Marley's 7, and they love Alcoholics Anonymous. They love y'all. A couple years after that marriage, I was asked to leave. And the most important thing in my life is the relationship with God and staying sober and living life based on spiritual principles. And for me, as a real alcoholic, I have to be involved with you people. And I have to be involved with newcomers and be a part of my home group and my area and my district. It just has to happen. She wasn't on board with that, and one reason or another, without going in, I left. And the last 2.5 years till I trying to get the divorce final, they hadn't seen their daddy come in, raising Cain and trying to whoop their mama. They've seen us go through this thing with level heads and clear talk without cussing and without any fussing and fighting and get through this like emotionally mature adults. The weekends that I have them is just unbelievable. If you're a daddy and if you've got girls, you know what these little girls can do in your heart. They've changed me. It's a gift from God that never would have happened without the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. There's been some great things that's happened in my life. I've been on the same job for 8 years. That don't happen. That don't happen, folks. I'm experiencing a way of life I never thought possible. Coming from where I've been, beat down, broke up, no hope, it's not going to be okay, have made destruction and hurt and pain and hurt the folks that have meant the most to me in my life, to be able to make those amends where I can and adopt a certain way of living and new ideas. And I know today that y'all are a child of God, and I'm a child of God, and it's my responsibility to treat y'all like that. I try to apply these principles at my job and at home. Y'all saved my life. Y'all gave me this. I can never, in the book say, I can never repay. You know, I owe so much. I felt God and you people this weekend. Alcoholics Anonymous is what saved my life, the steps. It's let me get to meet people like you whose spirit is so kind and true and so God-given. And we got to talk to Marion yesterday. And seeing what God's done in y'all's lives just does so much for me. I can't thank the committee enough. And Miss Joanne, I love you. And Milton for the friends that I've made and the acquaintances I made. And Gloria and Jim. And for getting to be a part of y'all's lives this weekend and this opportunity. And like Charles said, if had nobody told y'all they love you, I do. And thank y'all.